You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll review the day's top news stories here in the studio, from Syria and Israel to the crisis in Ukraine.
Putin and the rest of the top Russian leadership is putting on a very brave face, trying to act as if they're not concerned about the current sanctions regime that's been in place for some weeks now.
Then, 18th century Iceland saw one of history's great untold natural disasters. The authors of the new book Island on Fire will be here to explain why the volcano Laki matters in the modern era. Also, later in the programme... It's the 12th annual Kinoteka Polish Film Festival, of course. I'll discuss the best films with the festival's curator. All that, plus we'll check in with our man in Copenhagen, and we might have a song or two as well. That's all ahead on today's edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then in the next hour here on the show. Before we get started on all that, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley, who has the latest news from all around the world.
Russia's foreign minister has told his German counterpart today that all violence in Ukraine must be halted, primarily the use of the Ukrainian army and armed radical nationalists in southeastern Ukraine, the Russian foreign ministry has just said. It said that in a telephone conversation, Russia's Sergei Lavrov and Germany's Frank-Walter Steinmeier agreed that an Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe mission should play an active role in efforts to defuse tension in Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov also accused Washington of distorting last week's Geneva Agreement, designed to defuse the crisis, and criticised the US Secretary of State for an unacceptable accusatory tone. That's after John Kerry accused Moscow of using propaganda to hide the fact it is trying to destabilise the region.
President Putin and Russia face a choice. If Russia chooses the path of de-escalation, the international community, all of us, will welcome it. If Russia does not, the world will make sure that the costs for Russia will only grow. And as President Obama reiterated earlier today, we are ready to act.
Meanwhile, online news site Vice News journalist Simon Ostrovsky has spoken for the first time since he was released by pro-Russian separatists in the east of Ukraine. He had been covering the crisis in Ukraine for weeks.
Well, they said that basically I'm a lying journalist and that's why I was there. And they sort of beat me up as an introduction to the whole situation, blindfolded me, tied my hands behind my back. Then eventually they untied my hands and tied them in front of my body. And then they untied me totally, and then basically I was just hanging out in the room with the other prisoners.
Other news now. The pilot of a Virgin Australia plane flying from Brisbane to the Indonesian holiday island of Bali on Friday has reported a hijacking attempt after a passenger tried to enter the cockpit, an Indonesian transport official said. A Virgin Australia Airlines official said a 28-year-old male passenger who was drunk had banged on the door of the cockpit trying to get in. Crew members seized him and handcuffed him. He was arrested shortly after the plane landed in Bali. The US President Barack Obama says North Korea poses a threat not just to the region, but also to the United States, as he continues his tour of Asia with talks in the South Korean capital, Seoul. Concerns about Pyongyang's nuclear program was high on the agenda as he met with the South Korean President Park Geun-hye. Obama's in Asia for a week-long four-nation tour, with defense and trade dominating the agenda, although during his time in Seoul, he did express his sorrow at the loss of nearly 300 people in last week's ferry disaster.
The United States and South Korea stand shoulder to shoulder, both in the face of Pyongyang's provocations and in our refusal to accept a nuclear North Korea. Threats will get North Korea nothing other than greater isolation. And we're united on the steps Pyongyang needs to take, including abandoning their nuclear weapons and ballistic weapons program and living up to their international obligations.
Canada will not allow restaurants to hire more temporary foreign workers until the federal government completes an investigation into alleged abuses of a program designed to allow employers to hire foreigners to fill jobs for which no qualified Canadians are available. The moratorium only affects food service businesses and follows a decision by the Canadian unit of McDonald's to suspend all job applications made under the temporary foreign worker program. And finally, China will jail people who eat rare animals for 10 years or more under a new interpretation of the criminal law, state media reported today, as the government seeks to close a legal loophole and better protect the natural environment. China lists 420 species as rare or endangered, including the panda, golden monkeys, Asian black bears and pangolins, some of or all of which are threatened by illegal hunting, environmental destruction and the consumption of animal parts, includingly for supposedly medicinal reasons. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. That's Jonathan Wheatley with the news. Jonathan, you're something of a rare beast yourself. I think you're a one-off, though.
Do you think so?
Yeah, they certainly broke the mould when they fashioned you, Jonathan Wheatley. More news from Jonathan Wheatley. He'll be back with the latest headlines at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, right here on Monocle 24.
Van uit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.07. It's 13.07 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on the news, I am nothing short of delighted to welcome both Ivor Gaber, Professor of Political Journalism at City University right here in London, and Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, the London-based Policy Research Institute. Welcome both back to the programme. Great to have you with us. We'll start today's show with the story that's continued to dominate headlines. The situation in Ukraine. The rhetoric over Ukraine between Russia and the West continues to build and roll along. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has accused the West of wanting to seize Ukraine, in effect, as President Barack Obama pushes for fresh sanctions. The White House has been frustrated by a lack of consensus in Europe, notably between Germany and Italy, who've been hesitant to act. Meanwhile, 40,000 Russian troops remain on the border with Ukraine. Jane, perhaps if I can start with you. It's interesting, the troops remain there despite the rhetoric. That's a very real situation. Do you think there's a real possibility of Russian troops crossing the border, or are we at something of a sort of impasse at the moment? How would you characterise it?
Well, there's certainly brinkmanship going on here, and if it's something that comes down to pure military might, then at the end of the day, Russia has the upper hand. It's fairly clear that none of the Ukraine's Western allies actually want to back it militarily any more than they wanted to back the Syrian opposition militarily.
And what about the nature of what we're seeing, Ivor, on the ground? Because it's not just these troops who are seemingly recognisably Russian. There's also these various sort of militias, the masked men. There's a lot of claim and counterclaim about who exactly is what. Is that a clever tactic, do you think, out of Moscow? Or do you think it's fairly transparent to people watching from without?
I guess one of the points that the American Secretary of State made was they were all in neat, clean, new uniforms. Maybe Moscow should have distressed, I think the correct word is distressed, yes, their uniforms starting. But I did think when discussing this issue, probably in this very place a few weeks ago, that Mr. Putin had some grand plan. I don't think he does. I'm not sure he has a strategy. It's brinkmanship without knowing where the brink is. I think he was hoping that events would move along in a way that it would be obvious for him which way to go. And I speak with no knowledge of the psyche of Mr. Putin, but I can't see a strategy because, frankly, if he moves into eastern Ukraine, he's moving into a poor country, which essentially will be a drain on Russia, whose economy is far from strong. And if the sanctions are increased, he's sort of making a noose for himself. So I don't think he knows what to do next.
That's a really interesting point. And we've actually, we were sort of, as you say, though, Ivor, it's rather difficult. We're speculating on, you know, the nature of what is the Putin endgame. And people drew a lot of different conclusions. It was actually quite difficult for anyone to draw any conclusion for, I think, the reasons that Ivor has outlined. Jane, does it make more sense to you? It is a hard mind to read. What do you think his broader strategy even is?
Well, he's wanted to make Russia a player on the global stage again, and arguably he has. He's made it a power in the Middle East again. He, you know, got world attention with the Sochi Olympics, but this was meant to be the year of Russia's G8 presidency. The idea they had in mind was that they would focus on the important global issue of migration and be, you know, part of the global discussions on these things. In fact, instead, what you're seeing is global isolation, the rise of the G7, again, deliberately excluding Russia. So there are these questions about whether posturing over Ukraine is really worth it.
And if Ivor, I guess we sort of go along with that analysis that, you know, his endgame is a rather a blurred notion. Mm. Do you think that some of these other countries who certainly have been putting more pressure on some of their allies in Europe, in Western Europe in particular, are they safe? There's no question now, surely, that there'd be any further incursions, not even just talking about east of Ukraine, but perhaps into even other nations altogether?
Objectively, I'm sure analysts like Jane would say, yes, I'm pretty sure they're safe. But that's not how it feels when you speak to people in the Baltics, as I was recently. They're worried, actually very worried. They weren't worried 6 months ago, but even though you might say, look, you're part of NATO, you know, there's no way that Russia is going to try anything given the nature of the military alliance. I think they are. I'm not sure that people in Poland or Hungary or Romania or Bulgaria feel particularly worried, but I know people in the Baltic countries, former Soviet societies.
And do you think that is a sort of a diplomatic worry, if I can characterise it that way? Or do you think that's a very real...
It's a real worry because...
something of a very real threat, in fact.
In Lithuania, I think almost 50% of the population is Russian-speaking. And there is those same sentiments that has been voiced in eastern Ukraine have been voiced there. And I have to say that in my experience of the Baltics, in the aftermath of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Russian minorities or the Russian-speaking minorities were not treated with... They were treated as if they were part of a defeated enemy. And I think the social cohesion of the Baltic countries, well, particularly Lithuania, but to a lesser extent Latvia and Estonia, has not really stabilised because of that sense of victory and defeat.
Do you think that's why we've seen this big play that Putin made in the last week or so about the availability of passports, for example, to Russian speakers in former Soviet bloc countries? Is that one of the strategies? Does it give him a bit of a... Does it allow him to sort of stretch the tentacles a bit further into these kinds of locations?
Well, I think it's all part of this game that he's sort of playing, but I'm not sure he knows, as we were saying earlier, the end game. But he... had the, apart from, as Jane said, he had a sort of soft power approach this year with the Olympics, with the G8.
I'm not sure it's worked terribly
well. Well, I was going to say, Russia TV was the model of soft power, and it's now pretty hard. But he was at the same time trying to create this new federation involving Kazakhstan and Belarus, and possibly, well, he was trying to get Ukraine into it. I think that's all fallen apart. And that's why I don't think he has a strategy at the moment. He's thrashing around a bit.
Let's talk a little bit, or consider at least some strategies from the other actors in this. People talk a lot about sanctions, the ineffectiveness perhaps so far, and could more hard-hitting sanctions be the solution? A little earlier we heard from Joshua Yaffa, who's Monocle's man in Moscow. Let's just hear a little of what he had to say about potential sanctions up ahead against Russia. Let's take a listen.
Putin and the rest of the top Russian leadership is putting on a very brave face, trying to act as if they're not concerned about the current sanctions regime that's been in place for some weeks now, not concerned about a future round of sanctions, essentially betting so far that Russia can weather sanctions as they exist now, largely targeting individuals, not necessarily companies, and certainly not whole economic sectors. If those sorts of sanctions were to be enacted, say, against individual banks or even the banking or energy sectors in total, that would certainly have a much more dramatic immediate effect on the Russian economy. There was a very interesting proposal floated today by a rather hardline conservative advisor to Putin, Sergei Glazyev, who's really been driving a lot of Ukraine policy. In an interview with Russia's leading business paper today, he talked about a possible response to a new round of sanctions, quite a dramatic proposal where Russia would essentially withdraw in large measure from international capital markets, close down accounts denominated in foreign currency, force companies to execute trades and deals in rubles, a really circling the wagons approach that could be quite dramatic.
That was Monocle's Josh Yaffa, our correspondent in Moscow. I saw you sort of nodding there, Jane. What do you think of what Josh had to say? Do you sort of go along largely with what he was saying?
Well, targeting sanctions may not succeed, but it's the only thing that's got a chance of succeeding. You've got a huge economy here with a large oil sector. So it's a matter, if economic pressure is going to work, it needs to be economic pressure that gets to regime figures. But that does require untangling quite a complex web of interests.
And about, do you think there's a real appetite to do that? I mean, we touched upon it before on Monocle 24 about the difficulty with which you actually do untangle those varied interests, particularly the money. So much of it, you know, a lot of it tied up, of course, in the City of London, one could argue. Is there a real appetite to do that, or is that just too risky?
Well, absolutely. There's a lot of Western business interests there as well. A lot of Western businesses want to expand in Russia. There's important Russian assets here. There would be reluctance among people in the City of London, for example, that asset seizures could also alarm people from other countries that may have politically controversial behaviour. But there is
very delicately put,
absolutely, trying to avoid any...
let's talk a little bit about another sort of actor in this, which is NATO, because it seems to have enjoyed something of a sort of a renewal of its role. A lot of people sort of were writing obits for NATO. You know, the Cold War was over, it just become sort of defunct. And yet it does seem like there's kind of a new mission, really, for NATO. What do you think about that? Is NATO got an opportunity here to kind of restate its, I don't know, its mission, its purpose?
Well, I'm curious you use the word enjoyed some success. I'm not sure NATO has been a significant player in it. I suppose it's hovered in the background as a threat. Perhaps the breaking point, I'm not sure breaking point's the right word, but when Ukraine, the new government in Ukraine, talked about this very delicate area of seeking membership of NATO, maybe that was one step too far for Putin. Certainly he could, well, I would say he could live. Seeking membership of the EU is one thing, seeking membership of NATO, and the two don't necessarily go together. And I think NATO is not much, I mean, it's a problem is it's got a big stick, but not much else. What can it do? It can make noises, which it's done, but the sanctions aren't coming from NATO. Militarily, it's in a cleft stick. What does it do? It's not going to attack Russia. Is it going to put missiles into Ukraine, which isn't a NATO member, which would be a major provocation? I'm not sure. I'm not sure it's been as effective as, let's say, nothing's been effective, but I think we're down to bilateralism, to US intervention, maybe the EU. But NATO, it seems to me, unless we're going to think about war, dare I say, I'm not sure it has a significant role.
Let's move on to another rather complex diplomatic puzzle.
Well, that one was easy, was it?
Well, I feel like we've put that one to rights. Peace talks between Israel and Palestine. Let's see if we can solve this one in the next few minutes. After a unanimous decision by Benjamin Netanyahu's inner security cabinet, the Israeli government said it will suspend the talks given the Palestinian Authority's reconciliation agreement with Hamas. Jane, is this the sort of the death knell, the final blow, as some people are saying, to John Kerry's bid, the latest effort of many to try and bring some sort of resolution to even get the parties around the table? Is this the latest final blow, if you will?
Well, I think there's a bit of smoke and mirrors here. The deadline for this phase of talks expires in a few days anyway, and there are continuing contacts between both sides, but staying very much on day-to-day security issues. It certainly isn't something new that Israel wants to isolate Hamas and doesn't want to accept it as a partner in negotiations of any sort. So it is basically deja vu.
All over again, as Yogi Berra said. And Ivor, what about the sort of the Americans on this? Because Obama has suggested, hasn't he, on his Asian tour, he was in Seoul and he said there comes a point where you may just need to take a pause. Does he have a point? And if he does, how long will this pause be?
The peace talks have been taking a pause almost since they began. They've been showing very, very little progress. And there's been a number of attempts, as you've mentioned, for Hamas and the Palestinian Authority to get together, which have failed. And even this one, if you start to read the small print, it's quite a complex agreement they're moving towards. Although it's interesting, there are indications that the Egyptian military rulers are actually behind this and are giving it momentum. They feel that they would deal more easily with a Gaza Strip that was partially controlled by Mahmoud Abbas rather than purely Hamas. So it could, just forget the Palestinian-Israeli negotiations, this could play some, I won't say significant, it could some play some role in stabilising the other bits of the Middle East to some extent. I think one has to see it in a broader context. But frankly, in terms of the Israel-Palestinian negotiations, watch this space.
And Jane, just finally on that point, I mean, how long do you think we should watch the space for? I mean, it's difficult, isn't it, to try and put, you know, they tend to seem to be fairly arbitrary, the sort of dates that people bracket onto these sorts of pieces of analysis. What do you think would be a realistic time frame? Is it something maybe for the next US administration to ponder?
Well, it's always said it's only something a second-term American president will dare to deal with, and then that doesn't happen and the cycle continues. What will be interesting is if the Palestinians go for elections 6 months down the road, which has been hinted at in this agreement, and there I think you would see some Egyptian manoeuvring to try to get who would probably be their preferred candidate, Mohamed Dahlan, back in to Fatah and potentially replacing Abbas. He's 79. He said if there's elections, he will retire. So if they happen, there would be a new Palestinian leader. That will be something very important to watch.
That could be a big change. And just personnel-wise, you mentioned that idea about second-term US strategy, the opportunity for foreign policy incursion. How would we briefly, before we move on, sort of score Obama's efforts? I mean, John Kerry's bid, he certainly racked up the air miles, but he doesn't seem to have achieved that much. Does he just get a commendation for effort, but no real delivery in terms of what he's achieved?
There has been a lot of very detailed technical work going on that Kerry's been closely involved with, that's been having also backing from the government of Jordan, who's another important player here. So if some of that work that's been done, very sensitive discussion on Jerusalem, the Jordan Valley and refugees, if some of that material can be salvaged for whenever the next serious round takes place, that could be an important gain.
Interesting, and we'll, I'm sure, be talking about this again in the weeks, months and probably years that
Absolutely.
Follow. We'll take a short break now. Ivor and Jane will both still be here when we return. Up next, we'll be talking about Syria. Do stay tuned.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The Briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world. Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's 24 minutes past the hour. Still with me are both Ivor Gaber, Professor of Political Journalism at City University, and Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow in Middle East and North Africa at Chatham House. Let's turn now to a story that's, well, seemingly been overshadowed somewhat in recent weeks by the crisis in eastern Ukraine, the ongoing civil war in Syria. Just today, reports have emerged from opposition activists that a Syrian army helicopter dropped barrel bombs on a market in Aleppo yesterday. 24 people died in the incident. Ivor, I just wanted to ask you first of all about this, that from a sort of journalistic perspective. Do you think there is an element that the crisis in Ukraine, even thinking back to stories like the disappearance of flight MH370, they come to sort of dominate the news cycle, and it seems to leave
conflicts behind. So Syria was sort of almost forgotten for a few weeks. Is it another example of this kind of incredibly short attention span that the media and I guess consumers of the media actually have these days?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's incredibly short. I think if you did a count, Syria has been in the news fairly significantly over a number of years now. But it does remind me, and I'm now very old and going back to when I was a reporter in Northern Ireland and we had the Troubles. And I was a news editor based in Belfast and I'd phone London and they'd say, oh, not another bomb, not another riot, can't you got something else? And that does become, I mean, you know, I'm not defending it, but that's a fact of life. And they are thinking about the audience. You know, the audience does get immune, bored, turned off, whatever it is. So in the news business, we're part of the entertainment business, if you like. We've got to keep our audiences. And if there's nothing new to say about Syria, same old thing, it's understandable. I mean, we could have daily reports on the search for the Malaysian aircraft. How boring would that be, even though we're talking about, you know, huge loss of life? But we're in the entertainment business to some extent.
Just on that point, so what's the sort of the traditional newsman's sort of solution then to that problem? Do you find, or did you find, that you would sort of start to tailor stories off of things different? Or did you kind of, you know, stick to your guns and say, well, no, these are the important stories and they must be told?
Well, the creative, imaginative sorts of... whom I wish I was one, would look for different ways, different angles, sidebars, different ways of approaching the story. So let's just say one's got, and one sees it in Syria, some of the BBC reports, where let's say, okay, we've got the big story, let's look at how it's affecting a family. Let's look at that. You know, there was a very moving scene when that little boy, I'm trying to remember where he was, started crying. Sobbing in when that siege was lifted for Homs. It was very moving. So often we can recreate interest in these stories by focusing on the individual, focusing on a particular town, focusing on a particular family, whatever. So that's how we try and do it, I think.
Jane, if I can turn to you then, if we sort of draw back a little from those individual stories that we do still hear being told, often very eloquently and powerfully, you know, in the media, what about the big picture in Syria? We perhaps haven't discussed it with the same vigour just of late. What's going on? You know, how would you characterise what we're seeing now? Is it kind of more of the same? Is it still the situation of fracture and disorder amongst opposition groups? Where would you sort of say we're at the moment?
Well, the regime's been escalating its violence since it became clear that no one was going to stop it, to put it bluntly. But at the same time, there is an ongoing influx of fighters into Syria. They're not giving up either. So the situation continues to get worse. The neighbours continue to get more destabilised. Meanwhile, amazingly, Assad is planning to hold an election in July. The mind boggles as to how it's going to be carried out.
Well, on that point, we talked about how hard it is to read the end game of someone like Vladimir Putin. What on earth is Assad's broad strategy then with this election? Is this just the arrogance of someone who's seen things turn in their favour domestically? What could he possibly be trying to achieve or to broadcast to the world about his ongoing sort of objectives?
He wants to legitimise himself. In the very first year of this uprising, he's pushed through some constitutional amendments that made no difference but allowed him to claim to his supporters that he was acting in a democratic fashion. So again, there'll be an election. He'll probably win by something tasteful like 65 or 70% rather than 99%. And again, it will allow his supporters to sort of feel okay about him.
I'd just like to pick up on one point you mentioned there, which is the sort of influx of fighters to Syria. There's one interesting and particularly disturbing sort of side effect of what we're seeing as the civil war, which is a lot of foreign nationals, particularly European nationals, who are sort of travelling to take part in the conflict. A number of them, some sort of dying within those borders, some actually travelling back home again, ever more radicalised. Maybe they've received additional training, who knows what. The Met Police in this country have announced that a number of, I think it's 40 people have been arrested since the start of the year on suspicion of going to fight in Syria. That's quite an alarming trend, isn't it, Ivor? Do you think that, are we sort of alive to the risks of that? Or is it sensationalism to over-dramatise what is still ultimately not a huge number of people?
Well, the honest answer is I don't know, but I do query one assumption that's made, which is because they've gone to Syria, they will come back radicalised. Yes. One could actually make an argument that it could have the opposite effect. It could make them see the futility of violence or however you want to characterise it. So I wouldn't just assume. I would also, to be fair, and I was looking at an interview with, there was a boy in who was 18-year-old from Brighton in the South Coast who was a Muslim who went out there. His father said, look, he was going out there as a humanitarian. Now, whether he was or not, I'm sure some of those people, some of the Westerners, particularly Muslims, particularly who see their brothers or sisters suffering, have gone out there, like Westerners have gone out on humanitarian missions, officially or unofficially, over the years. So I wouldn't assume that just because young Muslim men, it is mainly men, have gone to Syria, A, they are jihadists and they've come back even more jihadist. It's probably a mixed picture. Having said that, I think the security forces are right to keep a very close eye on it, as they didn't, for example, with just thinking about a similar, the one of the people involved in the murder of a British soldier in Woolwich had been to Somalia, had been actually interviewed by the security forces in Somalia and had not been kept under surveillance in this country. So I think they're right to do it, but I think if they're going to do it, they ought to do it properly.
Absolutely. I'm afraid we must leave it there. We're out of time on today's programme. Thanks very much indeed to both my guests, Ivor Gaber from the City University and Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House. Thanks very much, as always, joining us here on Midori House.
My pleasure.
See you soon.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It is Monocle 24, it's Midori House, it's 18:31 here in London. There's plenty still to come in the rest of today's programme. We'll check in with our man in Copenhagen, preview the latest and greatest films in this year's Polish Film Festival right here in London, and discuss one of the great natural disasters that you've probably never heard of. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news headlines. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. Russia's foreign minister has told his German counterpart today that all violence in Ukraine must be halted. In a telephone conversation, Russia's Sergei Lavrov and Germany's Frank-Walter Steinmeier agreed that an Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe mission should play an active role in efforts to defuse the tension in Ukraine. The pilot of a Virgin Australia plane flying from Brisbane to the Indonesian holiday island of Bali has reported a hijacking attempt after a passenger tried to enter the cockpit. Virgin Australia Airlines official said a 28-year-old male passenger who was drunk had banged on the door of the cockpit trying to get in. He was arrested shortly when the plane landed in Bali. And the US President Barack Obama says North Korea poses a threat not just to the region, but also to the United States as he continues his tour of Asia with talks in the South Korean capital Seoul. Concerns about Pyongyang's nuclear program was high on the agenda as he met with the South Korean president. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Jonathan will be back, of course, with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. That'll be 1900 hours here in London. It's 18:33 at the moment, 14:33 in Rio. And it's time now on the programme to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading, not to Rio, but to Copenhagen. Our man there, Michael Booth, is ready and waiting with all the top stories. Michael, great to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us on the programme. We begin with, well, where else can we start but with Eurovision? I gather people are counting down furiously.
Yeah, good evening, Tom. Eurovision, what to make of Eurovision? It's kind of moved into a post-ironic zone, hasn't it? But it's still immensely popular. Do you want some facts and figures about Eurovision?
Absolutely, please, fire away.
After after Denmark won last year with an instantly forgettable song, they won the privilege of hosting 10,000 people in the final, which is going to be on the 10th, and is expected to attract 180 million viewers around the world, not just in Europe. This is something I didn't realize, but Eurovision is very big in places like Australia as well, which takes some explaining, but it's the truth apparently. But the first semi-final is on the 6th, and then the second is on the 8th, and as I said, the final's on the 10th. And it's taking place in a huge disused shipbuilding warehouse in a kind of disused part of Copenhagen Harbour called Refshavn. And they've redecorated, if you like, this huge shipbuilding hall to accommodate 10,000 people who are expected to come along. The highlight so far, or the first highlight, is going to be Russia versus Ukraine in the first semi-final. And, you know, I'd be betting on Ukraine right now with...
just maybe. They might get the popular vote.
In Europe, they're pretty popular, right? And so I wonder if they might surge forward on a well of sympathy.
Mm. Just one final point that occurs to me, Michael. In the last few years, we've seen, especially sort of post-2008, various countries who sort of said, look, we don't really want the privilege of hosting this because it's going to cost us an absolute fortune. We've got to host all these people, pour all this money into the infrastructure. We'd rather it went somewhere else. Has that been an issue in Denmark, or are people pretty glad that the party's in town?
No, it's definitely been an issue. Danmarks Radio, the national broadcaster, likes to put all of its money into these world-famous, acclaimed drama series, so it's not been too delighted to have to fork out however many millions of krona on hosting this rather kitsch bash. They have lined up some of their big stars, none of whose names will probably be familiar to anyone listening, apart from perhaps Pilu Asbeck, who played the spin doctor in Born, you may recall. The other two hosts are Nikolai Koppel, who's actually a classical musical guy, and an X Factor host. They're going to be the three presenters.
Nice blend, I think. That'll be pretty popular. Let's move on, Michael, talk a little bit about business, but the sort of business, the toy business, always interesting. Tell us about this, because there's some big players, aren't there, of course, in your neck of the woods?
Well, yeah, the turnaround of Lego in the last 10 years, that's not really a new story. It's been quite phenomenal, from sales declining at roughly 26% a year 10 years ago. They're now in a position where they're quadrupling profits. They're on a 9-year unbroken sales record run. This year, record profits up 10%, equivalent to Facebook, £900 million. But what has happened in the last month is they have become the most profitable toy company on the planet, overtaking America's Mattel. The main reason behind that simple figure is the fact that their bricks cost about $1 a kilo to make, and they sell them for about $75 a kilo. So it's pretty good business for the Danish company, who are constantly expanding, constantly innovating. They're about to build a £200 million factory in China. And the owner, it's still a family company, the owner is Denmark's richest man, worth about $7.3 billion, Kjeld Kirk Christensen. But the smart thing he did about 10 years ago was hand the company over to someone rather more professional to run it, rather than the family concern it had been. And that's really where the fortune started to change.
Well, and as indeed you say, the fortune certainly seemed to be set fair. Let's talk a little bit about, well, I guess another name, another sort of iconic name from where you are, but not in the toy manufacture. But we'll move into the culinary realm. Tell us about this, Michael.
Yeah, quite surprise news recently. Noma, Restaurant Noma, 3 times voted world's best restaurant by Restaurant Magazine in the UK, has decided and announced it's going to be upping sticks and moving to Tokyo next year, in the early part of next year, for 2 months to open up a restaurant. We don't know exactly where yet. I was talking to Rene via email the other day, but he was very cagey about this. I suspect he may not know exactly where yet, or the details are yet to be finalized. But yeah, Noma is moving to Tokyo for a couple of months. And the interesting thing is, of course, Noma made its name and pioneered new Nordic cuisine based on local seasonal produce. So they're not going to take the produce from the Nordic countries. They're going to source all of their produce from Japan. Now, you know, that's going to be a major transformation for their menu. Everything's going to have to change, and it's all going to be based on local ingredients in Japan. It's going to be quite a phenomenal undertaking.
Indeed. And I just wanted to ask you a bit more about that, Michael, because it's interesting that you have a name like Noma. It's so evocative. People instantly, as you said, it conjures these images of the very particular type of food. Do you think people will be slightly wary that in some ways it's, I don't know, almost kind of commodifying the name, and you can just sort of up sticks and drop in a new place and say, yes, it's still Noma, but it's all Japanese ingredients instead? Will that worry some people, or do you think generally people will be very excited because, you know, who knows where it might take them next?
Well, they did do a quite successful pop-up in Claridge's a couple of years ago, and the point here is they're closing down Noma in Copenhagen, and all 70 staff are going to Tokyo, so it's an extremely authentic move, if you like. It's the real deal. It's not just another branch or an expansion of the brand. It's the whole restaurant moving lock, stock and barrel to Tokyo. What's interesting is Noma has had this kind of bucolic image of foraging by the beach and, you know, wild plants. I don't know where they're going to find them in Tokyo, but I guess...
More foraging required. In short, though, yeah. Michael, will you be heading there? Surely you'll want to have a bash at trying the Japanese version, won't you?
Put it this way, I'll pull every string to get a reservation, but I would imagine half the foodies in the world are going to be doing that.
They might just be. Thank you very much, Michael. That's Michael Booth, our man in Copenhagen, with all the big stories from there this week. Up next on Midori House, we'll explore the volcano that turned 18th century Europe dark. Find out more next here on Midori House.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print, and that's 10 magazines, including two double issues and our two seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Ruto to Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world, and that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our two-year package for £170, which comes with two bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, centuries before a seemingly unpronounceable Icelandic volcano, we'll get onto that in a minute, I won't say it now, covered the skies of Europe with ash and closed airspace, of course, back in 2010. Another volcano caused far greater havoc, but you may not have heard of it perhaps until now. As our next guest explained, the story of Latke is one of Europe's greatest untold natural disasters. It caused deaths as far afield as the Nile and contributed to creating a famine that may even have triggered the French Revolution. The volcano story is told in the new book Island on Fire, and the authors Alexandra Witzer and Jeff Canippi join me in the studio. Now, welcome both to the programme. Thanks for joining us here on Midori House. How does something like this trigger that sort of chain of events? Describe for us, if you will, Alexandra, exactly how this sort of incident can kind of continue to roll out across continents even.
Yes, the remarkable thing about this eruption called Laki in 1783, it just absolutely dwarfed what you remember from 2010. So 2010, we had a bit of ash coming out of an Icelandic volcano for a couple of days. In Laki in 1783, we had gases pouring out for months on end, 8 months on end, not just gases, but also lava, the largest outpouring of lava we've seen in history. And what happened was those toxic gases spread all the way from Iceland across the seas to the UK, to continental Europe and beyond. They caused people to choke on some of the toxic fumes and also changed climate around the Northern Hemisphere for years.
I mean, it's extraordinary to think of, you know, climate being changed in this way. Jeff, perhaps if you can, I mean, you do it in the book, paint the sort of picture of what that experience actually was like for people. Did people really comprehend what was happening?
It happened at a time of the age, in the middle of the Age of Enlightenment. Newspapers were just really getting started, but communication across the seas was non-existent. It basically, an event that happened across the ocean was conveyed to people, say in the UK, by people on ships or travelers. And this event happened in Iceland, June 8, 1783. The first people in the UK and in Europe knew about it was that summer when this dry fog materialized. They knew not where it came from, and it lasted for months.
Extraordinary. Must have been absolutely sort of terrifying. I just wonder, in your sort of research for the book and as you were sort of telling the story, did you find that, as well as the detail of this particular incident, it became the story of volcanoes and the story of volcanology? It's fascinated, you know, geologists and scientists alike. Did you find that it sort of expanded, if you like, as you sort of delved ever deeper?
Yes, we talk about this as the volcano that changed both the history of Europe and the history of science, because this was at a time when natural philosophers were turning into actual natural scientists. They were looking at what was going on around them and trying to understand it. Some of the characters in the book include Ben Franklin, who was ambassador to Paris in the time, and he was observing, he watched this dry fog roll across his garden and he wondered what it could be. And he was one of the very first few to say, hey, maybe this was an eruption. Maybe this is from a volcano. Maybe this is from all the way in Iceland. It was the first time anyone had any idea that an eruption so far away could have such dire consequences for our lives here. And that was driven home 4 years ago, of course, with the with the ash disruption and the airplane shutdowns.
Well, I wanted to ask you a bit more detail about this, not just because I'm going to maybe test to see if you can actually pronounce it any better than me. I didn't even try, as you will have noticed. Do you think it's interesting that maybe, you know, people's failures to sort of, I don't know, learn the lessons of history, because there was such media, you know, it was a media extravaganza, and yet there were lessons from history that people perhaps should have learned and they hadn't. Do you think people have failed over the centuries since to really come to understand these sorts of things in the natural world?
Well, we come to view natural disasters as being extremely localized. And so what happens across the world affects them. You know, tsunami may kill hundreds of thousands of people, but it doesn't touch us. Whereas an event that happens on global proportions is very, very rare. Say an asteroid impact, which really hasn't happened. It could, and it would have a global impact if it were big enough. And something like Laki did have a global impact, but it was at a time when people just didn't realize how something could happen in a small part of the world could affect the whole thing. So I don't think it's you know, we haven't learned our lesson. We just haven't had enough lessons.
Well, I fear with the way things are going, there may be ever more. Let me just ask you a little bit about actually sort of working on a volume like this, how the sort of your writer's mind works and how the story takes shape. Is it that you just become increasingly sort of fascinated by the story, and the more detail you discovered, you thought, hang on, there's more of a story to tell here? Or was it a project that arrived in a rather different way? How did it actually sort of come about?
Well, it came about after 2010, so let's just go ahead and say it. Eyjafjallajökull, the island mountain
glacier.
That was
very elegantly done indeed.
Lots of practice there, you can imagine. So I went to report on Icelandic volcanoes that summer, several months after the eruption, after we could get flights in. And in the process of roaming around with some University of Iceland scientists, they kind of waved over their shoulders and said, hey, you know, back there is the biggest lava flow that we've ever seen in historic times from this eruption called Laki. And I thought, number one, that's exciting because it's big. Number two, I can pronounce Laki. From there, it just took off, really. There's an incredible story behind it of a priest, a pastor who lived in South Central Iceland, right around the place this eruption was happening. And he chronicled the whole thing. He had this amazing diary from the start of the eruption, from earthquakes trembling the ground to lightning and thunder flashing over the hills to the ash appearing to the lava about to engulf his village. He's an amazing character and a very early scientist. Again, this concept of the birth of science. He was observing the natural world around him and said, this is what I see, this is what I observe. And today's volcanologists actually use his chronicle as a way to understand eruptions in progress.
And all of this stuff survived. I mean, one imagines you could see such desolation that you would lose all of these precious records, but there's enough material that survived, is there?
Yeah. His account has been translated into English only recently, and then also modern volcanologists only recently have started to really probe what happened there. So there's kind of a confluence of the historic records coming out into translation, and then also modern scientists taking an interest in going out and mapping what happened and modeling what might happen if this were to happen again.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to just ask very briefly, Jeff, what next? Is this the you know, Island of Fire? Could we see you sort of cycling around the globe, telling the stories of all these other, because there's so many extraordinary volcanic events that seem to just captivate people in a way that few other, well, natural events of any sort do.
We tend to look at this as kind of a moral tale for the planet. We have to keep a pulse on what's happening with the planet to find out what's going on. To do otherwise is unwise and incompetent, actually. And what's next is, I think we raise awareness. This was an eruption that happened at a time just before mass communication. And these things have happened before. They're going to happen again. It's not an if, but a when scenario. And all we're saying is, you know, we're not saying run and hide, this is going to happen tomorrow, but it's going to happen somewhere. I mean, Iceland is a volcanic country. And another event like this could happen. It may not be an ice, a Laki-like eruption, but another one could very well happen, which is to be aware of it.
So be aware. And one way you can do that is to read Island on Fire. Alexandra and Jeff, thank you both very much indeed.
Thanks
for coming to tell us all about it here on Midori House.
Thank you.
Now I want to sort of set the Island on Fire to music in some way. So let's stay
on that volcanic isle. Let's stay in Iceland. From there, this is of Monsters and Men. This is Dirty Paws. That was the sound of Monsters and Men with Dirty Paws, a great track from Iceland. We were there before, of course, with our book Island on Fire. And we're ticking towards the top of the hour, but because it's Friday, we're going to talk reviews. We're talking film. The Kinoteka Polish Film Festival is now back in its 12th year. It's a five-week event featuring the very best in Polish film, visual arts and music. And as my next guest will explain, the highlight this year is a retrospective of the famous artist and filmmaker Valerian Borowczyk, which runs at BFI South Bank and the ICA throughout May and June. Anna Godlewska is the festival's curator and director of the Polish Cultural Institute in London, and she joins me now to talk through that and a few other highlights this year. And it must be a very exciting time. What are you sort of most excited about for the festival this year?
Well, Valerian Borowczyk retrospective, definitely this is a highlight of our program.
And tell us, what kind of things will people be seeing and experiencing then? How have you sort of managed to summarize this great career?
Basically, Borowczyk retrospective at the BFI South Bank is taking place in May, and we have prepared for you retrospective of his feature films as well as animations and short films. And in May as well, we are launching on the 20th May the exhibition of Borowczyk's artworks at the ICA in London.
Fantastic. So it's a real, it does capture this sort of, because it's an incredibly varied career, such talents, very diverse skills.
Yes, he was very talented and quite innovative at his in his times.
Oh, I hate people like that. They always show me up in such a bad light. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other treats that we've got to look forward to. Tell us about what we'll see at the National Gallery. This is Field of Dogs. Tell us a bit more about this one.
To the National Gallery this year returns Lech Majewski, a famous Polish film director and artist as well. And on the 24th of May, there will be a film screening of his newest film, Field of Dogs.
And what should people expect from Field of Dogs? Is it a surprise, a bit of a departure, or will we sort of recognise it instantly?
Lech Majewski is very famous of his picturesque and artistic films. And his way of filming is very exceptional, so people will really enjoy it, I'm sure.
And they'll see his eyes straight away. Yeah,
yeah. It is a visionary love story, this film.
Wonderful stuff. It's interesting, actually, because there's an incredible relationship, isn't there, between the sort of visual arts and movies. And people will probably know the sort of Polish movie posters, an incredible art form all of its own. That's something I'm a sort of bit of a fan. Why do you think that is? It's interesting, isn't it, that there's such an intriguing relationship. It's almost like some of these filmmakers and artists look at the world almost a bit differently.
Well, usually there are artists and then they define themselves as visual artists or filmmakers. This is like a secondary choice.
It's intriguing stuff. Let's also talk about, because it's far and wide all across London over the next few months, the Barbican too, of course, one of the great venues. Ida, Paweł Pawlikowski, tell us more about this.
Paweł Pawlikowski is a Polish filmmaker based in Paris, and he also worked in London for several years. Ida is his newest film, and it won an award during the London Film Festival last year. It's about a novice nun who is told by her mother superior that she'll be accepted into the church after she visits her relative. It's her aunt, and the story is quite mysterious, and she discovers her past and the secrets of her family, as well as secrets of the history of Poland.
It's always good, isn't it, to have that sort of a journey like that, a narrative journey. Just talk in more broad terms, just before we run out of time, about the film festival itself as a whole entity. 12 years, as we mentioned, a whole month is such a big programme. What's the responsibility like being tasked with sort of running such an event? Do you sort of enjoy it more year on year, or how do you sort of find dealing with all of those responsibilities?
This is always an exciting moment to start the festival, and then after completing it, we're looking forward to the next edition of it. So we are enjoying it ourselves in our team at the Polish Cultural Institute, but also it's a great responsibility because we address the festival program to the very diverse and versatile audience here in London, and as well as in other cities in the UK.
So much to enjoy. People can enjoy it, find out more all through the next couple of months, events throughout London. Anna Godlewska, thank you very much for coming to tell us all about it here on Midori House. And that is, I'm afraid, all we have time for on today's edition of the show. My thanks to my guests from earlier, Iva Gaber and Jane Kinnamont. And my thanks to my producer, Daniel Giacopelli, as well as our researchers, Alexa Firmanich and Michaela Aitken, and our studio manager, Joel Church. The menu with Marco Sippi is next up after the news. Do stay tuned for that. This programme will, of course, be back at the same time, 1800 hours London time, on Monday. But for the Friday edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye.
From London to Beijing.
This is Monaco 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
to Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monaco 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.